Welcome to the Philosophy of Now podcast from Roots Media. In this podcast, we speak with thought leaders about their philosophy on life that doesn't merely define them in their past or doesn't come for their ambitions in the future, but is their life mantra at every moment, ever present in their now. So join us on a journey of questions and deep thought that ultimately lead to one question that truly matters. What is their philosophy of now? And in the process of listening, maybe we'll introspect and we will meditate or even stumble upon our own. In our episode today, we learn from Raghunath Kapo. From being a young lead member of a popular punk rock band, the youth of today, we championed principles of vegetarianism and clean living, to becoming a monk for the Krishna Consciousness Order. Kapo guides us through his life realizations and journey. Currently, Kapo is a renowned yoga teacher, leading retreats, camps, and training courses across the globe in Ayurveda, clean living, kirtan music meditation, and scriptural studies. Kapo continues with his music, leading his punk rock band called Shelter, producing tracks on spirituality and bhakti or devotion, and also hosts his own podcast, called The Wisdom of the Sages. Kapo speaks with us candidly about his journey living an extremely simple life after letting go of his famous young band, the value of using your passion and art as a means for a higher purpose and devotion, what spirituality means to him living in the real world, and ultimately at the core, what keeps him grounded, his philosophy of now. One of the most honest conversations we've had from such an amazing personality. Without further ado, the philosophy of Raghunath Kapo, now.
Thank you, Raghu, for joining us on our podcast today and making time out of your busy schedule.
Honored. Thank you.
So I guess we could start with your early childhood and growing up on the East Coast, I take it. What were your influences in terms of turning to spirituality? Did you have any exposure as a child growing up in high school that made you take this path eventually in life? Like what was it about your childhood that made you, this engrossed?
It's a tough one to figure out what made you take what path. Is it coming from this life? Is it coming from some influence in this life? Sometimes there's a very strong pull in this life. You meet someone, you read a book, it changes the trajectory of your life. But, with the Vedic paradigm, if you were to zoom out of that, you could see, well, actually, that's because previously in your last life, you were very inspired and something happened. You were, as Krishna says in the Gita, they say that the unsuccessful yogi, after a little bit of endeavor, gets some good karma in their next life. And the unsuccessful yogi, after a massive endeavor, they get born into a family of transcendentalists. That's from the sixth chapter of the Gita. So we tend to see life, in the Western world, in this lifetime. Well, what was it? What was that? What was that pinch or what was that push that goaded you towards a spiritual path? All I can see is the what little springboards or little trampolines that made me move towards it in this life. Who knows where I was in a previous life, but I've always had an interest in spiritual things, in renunciation as opposed to indulgence, in sense control instead of sense indulgence, in spiritual principles or spiritual guidelines. In a very broad way, I was raised Catholic. Nothing really spoke to me, but I appreciated the idea of integrity-driven living that speaks, I think, through all spiritual cultures. And I did also have my own belief system outside of it. I think I was telling the story. I do a lot of interviews, so I can't remember if I told a story or where I told it, but I remember when I went to university for a year, and I didn't want to get caught into the party animal of university life, which is classic in America. We grew up with this movie, Animal House. And our idea is, I don't want to become one of these frat guys. I'm not turned on by it. So I thought I would join a Christian organization. Not that I was a Christian, but I thought, you know, at least it's good company. These guys are like, they're not focused. They don't want to just party every night. Right. I thought it would be good company. Yeah. But my problem in that Christian organization was I love Buddhism. And I felt like the teachings of Buddha and the Dhammapada were very similar to the teachings of Christ. And when I found that book, I fell in love with it. And then I decided, oh, I'm going to share this with all my Christian buddies. And they weren't so happy. They weren't so happy with it. So I found out very quickly that there's a difference between wide-gated spiritual paths and exclusivism in spiritual paths. And I was more of a wide-gated person. And the more I studied Vedic thought, the more I realized, like, this is more for me. We understand that everybody's on some path, and that the different spiritual truths are to bring us to the one truth, which is connection with source. And you can see that even in things like a 12-step program, or you can see that with all... truthfully, I feel like I'm a better Christian now that I study the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. Hmm. You know, that might sound crazy, but I believe like I can actually go with my mom to church and appreciate it better than all my siblings, even better than my mother. And I feel like I can read the Bible now, and it makes much more sense than it did when I was 16 years old. Don't get me wrong. I didn't fall from the heavens. I went through everything a kid goes through in life in America. And when I see you guys, I'm quite impressed. Truthfully, I'm impressed with your parents, because oftentimes, and I get it, we want to chase the American dream. It's an attractive dream that you can be determined and create your life with your hard work and your endeavor and put your nose to the grindstone. And a lot of times when you're in a third world country, India, India considered third world?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's still third. Technical term is developing country, but the old term
developing. I think it's politically incorrect to say third world now.
Yeah. Right,
it's a developing country. So, a lot of times you can do everything right, and you can still hit an economic ceiling. Mm-hmm. And so I understand the desire to move to New York or move to send your kids to college in Toronto, and this is. Where, just because I know India very well, I know Indians pretty well, I know this is the game plan. And the kids become very successful, because that same type of focus in India, the competition's high and the rewards may not be so high. And so get them out of America. And I get that. Unfortunately, it's a Faustian gamble. It's a Faustian contract where you're sometimes very often selling your soul. Mm-hmm. Mm. Right? Selling your integrity, selling your dharma to get the American dream. Yeah. And so that's a problem. And I see it happen with a lot of Indians. And then Indians embrace this type of Americanism. And it becomes very sad, because I can speak for a card-carrying American. Been there, done that. Now what? Mm-hmm. That's the mantra for someone who's really lived that and indulged in that and has, you know, lying in the gutter and thinking, what the hell? This is supposedly, this is Hollywood. This is what you're supposed to have. This is the dream. I'm living the dream. And that's why a lot of Americans or people from Western world who've had everything, who've traveled all over the world, who could buy a second car or a second home, who's filled their senses, who's eaten more than they can eat, who's had sex more than they could have sex, who's, you know, has been to every beach you could think of that's like pristine and white sand and black sand and crystal clear and snorkel dived and parasailed. We've done it.
Yeah.
And they end up, get ready, India, because it's coming. in a 12-step program, or a drug addicted, or living on the streets, or have lost their lives, or lost a loved one, or they're sick of it. They're sick of it. They've hit rock bottom, and they're lying in the gutter, but they're looking up. How do I get the hell out of here? Mm-hmm. Sometimes in India, it's the opposite. It's, okay, I followed Dharma. I've done what my grandfather did and his father did and my mother has told me. And in one sense, they're very close to integrity-driven living with Dharma and with connection and with ritual, with substance, and even understand the ritual. But their back is to God. Their back is to spirit. And they're focused more towards, how can I consume? How can I live that good life that is shared in Hollywood? So when I see you guys who are both like, you're in this, I see you guys in the material world. You're in it. You're working it, you know? But you have some grounding in Dharma and some spiritual life. It's quite impressive. It's quite impressive. And it's, you know what a slack line is? A slack line is like, it's like a, you tie it to one tree to another and you try to balance it. And some people do tricks on it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, I feel like people like yourself, you're doing tricks on the slack line, meaning you're finding that balance between spiritual and material life. And it's quite attractive to a person like me. And I'm impressed. So good job. And good job with your parents.
I think you're definitely giving us more credit than we deserve. But
maybe I got to get to know you.
I would say all credit goes to the ancestors, our guru, and the parents. I don't think we really...
That's the proper answer. All I'm going to reiterate what he just said, because a lot of people don't get this. All credit goes to the ancestors. It's amazing how we have this concept in America called a self-made man. And I don't even think that can even exist in Indian thought. Like, I am made of what I am. My success, my fortune, my greatness is made because I just did it. I just went for it. I was unafraid. And it's a deep-rooted arrogance without giving any credit to your ancestors. Like, that's like an amazing concept. A lot of times in America, we'll even give credit to, my parents. I had good parents. But we won't go past there. But it's actually, it's a bloodline that we're in debt to. I had grandparents that say, you know what? I'm going to get on a boat. I'm going to get on a boat because we're suffering. We're struggling like anything. There's no hope whatsoever, but I heard of a place where there's hope, and they got on a boat. I would never get on a boat.
Right.
You know, I get seasick in the Central Park rowboats. I can't imagine getting on a ship and then trying to figure out, and then just getting put here and like, now what?
Right.
Here in New York City, now what? I got to figure out life. I got to find a bunch of Italians and live with them. When I hear the story, and you know, it was the time of the Depression. You know, it's like, I don't know how my grandparents pulled it off, or their parents, etc. So yeah, we're in debt to our ancestors. And then you said the gurus, our parents, and our gurus, our teachers. We're in debt to our teachers. Oftentimes, people who claim they're self-made men, so to speak, they don't give any credit to the people that wrote the books they studied.
Yeah.
They want all credit. This is an incredible thing. We are so in our ego that we want full credit for any success. And it just doesn't work that way in reality. You get some credit. You tried hard. There's some credit for that.
Right.
But you don't get full credit.
People could try as hard as the person who has material success and not get material success, just to prove that it's not only effort that... gives you.
It's not only effort, exactly. Some people put in that same amount. So there's some karma there, and there's some blessings there, and there's some good instruction, and there's some bloodline we're dealing with. Sometimes we're dealing with crazy bloodlines, you know, from a previous life.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about music, because both of us are musicians. We both play tabla, sing, and obviously you're an established musician. And growing up in the 90s, I kind of have some sense of what Youth of Today was. But
where'd you guys grow up?
In Jersey.
In Jersey, okay.
What drove you to punk rock music? Like, how was that an outlet for you? in your expression?
You know, I think what drove me to it was I was drawn to the fringe society. I didn't want to be like everybody else. I wanted to find my own uniqueness at a young age. I didn't want to buy the clothes off the rack. I didn't want to be like, you know, I wanted to be part of like a bigger forest instead of a monocropped tree that's planted wearing the same things everybody else wears, the same outfits, the same hair, the same thoughts, the same. I wanted to be a free thinker, a critical thinker. I didn't want to opt in towards Democrat or Republican. I wanted to think for myself. And I think that's sort of like, it's always lacking, I think, critical thinking. I wanted to read and study, and I wanted to listen to fringe music. I didn't want to play other people's music. Like, I grew up playing the violin and the trumpet in an orchestra and a band. And the more I started getting into the beauty of classical music, the more I started realizing, like, you know what? My orchestra is nothing better than a cover band. You know what a cover band is? Cover band is like someone who plays the best of Led Zeppelin at a local pub, or the best of, you know, they're playing all the hits. They're like a wedding band. They're playing all your favorite hits.
Yeah, they're great musicians, but there's no originality.
There's no originality. They're incredible musicians. They hang out at Guitar Center, and they have great equipment, and there's no originality whatsoever. Yeah. And so I was like, for me, I wanted to write my own music. I wanted to speak my own words. And so I got into that at a young age. And the more I realized, like, these orchestra, this is a cover band. They're not Beethoven. They're not Mozart. That stuff was radical. This stuff is just cover music. You guys are trying to cover other people's music. Write your own music. Sure. Instead of playing their music perfectly, I liked it, but I felt like it was lame. It was completely lame. I didn't want to be that. So I just started writing my own music. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not a talented musician. So punk was a great fit for me because you didn't have to be so talented. As I got better and as I started playing over the years, we got more refined. I sang a little better than I did. But there was also some testosterone from being a teenager that had to come out. And it was I felt like we used it in a very positive way. That type of fierceness that comes out in a teenage male that could come out in a lot of negative ways.
Speaking of your relationship with punk rock, you know, when we typically see what we may call like devotional or spiritual music, it is usually associated with music that is very calm and serene and meditative, or what you may call in Sanskrit sattvic, right, which is like pure. That sort of music is, you know, either seen as bhajans and kirtans, or they may be more, you know, church music, choir music. How did you make punk rock something that is, as you even said, very energetic, very outward, very external, very active? How did you make that sort of music something that you pointed out as more devotional? Something that was a spiritual outlet for you, or something that helped you, guided you towards your higher goal? How did you make that art form something that could almost be contradictory to what you're seeking to do?
Music is an energy. Just like fighting. Fighting is an energy. And I could go around and just find people that are weaker than me and beat them up. And that is a poor use of that energy. It's not poor. It's a poor use for my consciousness. It's cruel. It's illegal. It's problematic for everybody involved, maybe except me, unless I get caught. Or I could use my strength and my martial skills to protect people. I see a vulnerable getting hurt, a woman getting beat up, or raped, or a child getting beat up, and I could use my martial skills for protection, or a male, or another man getting beat up. So martial arts isn't good or bad. It's how you use it. And you're right. Even like martial arts, it's not a sattvic skill. But even within rajasic activities, like, let's keep that same analogy, like fighting, you can refine it. Mm. You can refine the fighting, the rajasic thing, to be sattvic. Look at sex. Right. Sex, rape is sex. Meeting a woman at a bar and having sex is sex. Or calling a spirit to enter the womb so you can raise that child on a spiritual path, that's also sex. Those are three different, completely different things. Mm. Now, the act of intercourse creates a baby, so that's rajasic activity. But within rajas, you can also have a very refined rajas. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So going back to music, you're right, truthfully. Sattvic music, Vedic music and tablas, and the singing of bhajans and the mantras is so refined. But if you are doing it for your ego or to impress people, then you've taken something very high and you've crippled it slightly, or you've defiled it.
Right.
So it's not necessarily sattvic if you're doing it in a non-sattvic way or a way that's led with the ego. So in the same way, you can take something as fierce and noisy as punk and put a message that's positive, uplifting, creates change, and use that vehicle to speak to people who already understand that language. That music is a language. Now, suppose I was like, suppose I have a very good recipe, had a baked pie. I think it was pie day the other day, the 14th. Mm. So I have a great recipe for pie, but I'm telling a bunch of people in Italian and all I speak is English. They're not going to even understand that recipe. Even though it's the best recipe ever, I'm speaking in a different language. Mm. So I can use the language of music to speak to people who understand that language. Like, for example, if you're not familiar with hip hop and all you listen to is Chopin or Mozart or Beethoven, and you've never heard hip hop, you're going to be like, all this stuff all sounds the same. It doesn't sound the same. It's all completely different.
Yeah. Trust me. We grew up in the hip hop era, and we have older Indian people always like, this all sounds the same. It's like, no, it doesn't.
Hey, they say that with everything. And someone listening to hip hop exclusively will listen to Indian bhajans and they'll say, oh, this pundit sounds just like this pundit, and this lady sounds just like this lady. And, you know, to them, it all sounds the same. Right. So you can use whatever language it is. And I will agree that punk is it's rough around the edges. But the message is actually what changes people. Mm-hmm. Sattvic music can bring you to sattva, but the mantra is carried by the raga and the tal. The mantra is carried by the raga and the tal. That means that sound vibration is carried by the melody and the percussion. And so when you do it correctly, what you guys are doing with tablas and chanting and stuff like that, the raga and the ta, when done that mantra correctly, that pierces and goes right through the heart. It's such a beautiful way. But I have to be able to willing to let that in my life, right?
Yeah.
If all I know is punk music or hip hop, and I let that in my life, then you can use a very powerful beat in hip hop or in hardcore or punk rock or in speed metal. You can use that very powerful raga, the melody, and the raga and the, what's the, I just forgot the word. Raga and the tal, the beat, to carry a message of destruction or a message of creation. You know, a message of positive or a message that's negative. And maybe that's the language people can only hear. They can only hear it through heavy metal or speed metal. Mm. So that's what we did with our band. Before I really understood Vedic thought, I was just interested in positive living, vegetarianism, sense control, controlling your mind, not anti, I was against intoxication, I believed in laws of karma, and that was sort of our message. And it was very popular within a straight edge scene, which was a bubble within the hardcore punk scene. The people who were into our hardcore punk, they might have liked the music, but they thought, oh, screw this. I just want to have a beer. These guys are cool, but I'm just going to get drunk tonight. Yeah. But that was our message. And it was a little bold of a message at the time, because New York City at that time was filled with drugs and alcohol, intoxications, huffing glue, LSD, everything.
Mm, yeah.
But that was our message. And I didn't expect people to pick up on it, but people picked up on it. And then it created a scene almost within a scene of people who wanted to, who appreciated that type of clean living and that regulation and that sattvic living. And from there, I got turned on to more spiritual facets of Vedic culture and spirituality, because you get to a point of sense control and regulation and finding peace within your mind that you want to go, well, now what? Is this the goal? Is just to be like Ned Flanders from like The Simpsons? Is that the goal of life? Just to be regulated and ethical? Like, where are we going with this? What's the point of it? Just to be a good neighbor? And the idea is, no, that's a threshold to get deeper and deeper types of meditation. It's not the end. Big deal. You're a vegetarian. So is a pigeon. Pigeons don't eat meat. Big deal. Is that the goal? Is just to be pigeon-like? No, the idea is I want to get to deeper and deeper, because this is what will happen next. If you're really intuitive and if you're really listening, right, there's a whisper of God. And you'll find out that the next thing, after you stop doing these things, which we generally do for ego, tons of illicit sex is done for your ego. That's the pleasure of sex. It's the fraction of the pleasure you get from the, it's happening in a moment. It's really most of the pleasure, 99.9% is the ego. She thinks you're hot, or he thinks I'm hot. And we're if you actually analyze the act of sex, it's painful. Because to actually enjoy, there's like a fear, because the act in itself, there's this fear of, if I enjoy, it will be over. So I'm going to try to hold off. So you're trying to hold back pleasure. And then once you enjoy, it's over. So you're trying to think, I want to enjoy, but I don't want to enjoy. Because if I enjoy, it's over. But I want to enjoy, but if I don't want to enjoy. And it's all because it'll be over. And you're just like, it's like type of schizophrenia of like, try to enjoy, not to enjoy, not to enjoy. And then when it's finally over, it's like, poof, that's it. It's like, that's it. It's underwhelming. And that's why Thomas Aquinas says, all animals are sad after sex. Because it's sort of like, it's underwhelming. And a lot of times people who are just really driven by the act of sex alone and have no relationship with the person, when it's purely rajas and tamas, then they get to this point like, what the hell did I just do? What did I do? Sure. And the way the male machine works, because we are not men or women. We are two different meat machines. It's just like you're driving, there's a Porsche and a Kia. They're just different. They're not, one's not bad or one's not good. But the male machine is driven by lower chakras, by lower energies in general. Sure. And women don't get too proud here, because the women are also driven by different chakras as well. And so when a male gets their release from sex and they are not into it, they were just driven by those lower chakras, they want out. They're like, I want to get out of here. I had my beer goggles on. They even say things like that. Or I wasn't even interested. And the girl might say, the girl who's more triggered by their heart and their mind, they'll say, do you love me? And the guy will be like, I don't even like you. A guy can have sex without even liking a person. That's how they're driven. It's actually pathetic. And that's why men are very close to animals. And women can be very, very divine. Now, don't get me wrong. Women can get sick of the head, and men can be special. And it can vacillate depending on how we live our life. But the machine is made differently. And we can't just whitewash and say, nah, we're all the same. We're not all the same. In the same way, a Mack truck is different than a Ferrari. A Ferrari is not better than a Mack truck. If I want to move 10,000 cantaloupes from Sacramento to New York, I'm not gonna pick a Ferrari, you know. But if I want to get there quick, I'm gonna pick the Ferrari. So they have different benefits, and so our equality is not based on our body. Our equality comes with that we're spiritual beings. Mm.
Going off and continuing on that, the punk rock and what it means to you. You know, you use something, like we said earlier, that is not usually the cliched spiritual tool, right? It's not the kirtan. It's not some sort of ritual. It's not meditation. And you use that music form, your passion, and you used it as a means, a tool for your holistic spiritual development. And it kind of goes on to show that a certain, you know, something that could be your belief system here, that you could use your passion as a tool for something higher, for your life purpose, for your spiritual purpose, for something that's deeper. And whatever that passion is, whatever that art is, whatever that tool is, whatever that activity or occupation is, how important is that? How important is it to make a passion or make a job or make an activity or make a tool into a means to something higher in your life?
In the tradition I study from, there's this word called yukta vairagya, which means a genuine renunciation. Genuine renunciation doesn't mean I just give up, but I see that everything is divine. And therefore, like, for example, right now I'm using a microphone. I can use this microphone for hate speech, or I can use it for spiritual speech. So it's not the microphone that's bad. It's how I'm using it that's good or bad. If I'm using a microphone and technology to create complication and pain for other people in this world, then it's material. But if I'm using anything in a spiritual way for the upliftment of others and myself, then I've spiritualized it, because ultimately everything is God. In truth, everything is ultimately coming from God and therefore is part of God. And so what the practitioner of bhakti yoga is we are re-spiritualizing matter. My harmonium, I have a harmonium I'm looking at right now. It's a musical instrument that I chant with. My harmonium is just wood. Is wood spiritual? No, and yes. I mean, in one sense, it's part of the material world, and it rots, right? It will break down. You can burn it. In one sense, it's matter, but ultimately it's coming from God, and therefore, in one sense, it's spirit. How I use it makes it spiritual or material. I can use it. I can sing in hopes that you think I'm cool. If you think I'm cool when I sing, then I'm using that to endorse my ego. Mm-hmm. But if I'm using it because I'm focused on mantras for my own liberation, right? If I'm using it for mantras that affect your mind and the consciousness of other people, then that's a very beautiful thing. Then I'm taking wood and re-giving it back to spirit. And that's the spiritualization of matter. And that's what real alchemy is. It's taking, you know, the idea of alchemy is you take a base metal like mercury and turn it into gold. We're taking matter and turning it into spirit by how we use it. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely it makes sense. And I think that connects to what I was thinking about. We hadn't spoken about it yet, but I think in this pandemic, a lot of people started looking inward, due to some stress or mental health calamity that might have come upon them, and B, due to the fact that they were not interacting with anybody else. They were not going out. Their daily routine of externalizing their desires just kind of ceased to some degree.
Sure.
So, in this pandemic, when you have a bunch of students who you speak to virtually, and you know, to your own family, what do you think about your spiritual life enhanced your ability to cope with the pandemic?
The good question. The very core of spiritual life is we try to find something solid in a world that is by nature not solid. We try to find something steady in a world which by nature is unsteady. We try to find something to grab onto in a world where things crumble in your fingers. So if I'm crumbling, right, this isn't me talking. I'm not such a deep philosopher, but this is Vedic thought. The material world is like a sandcastle. If you've ever built a sandcastle at the beach, it's fun. Expect for it to dissolve very soon. If I build my house out of sand, right? If I'm trying to sell Raghav, if I'm just, hey, I got a great beachfront property. I'm a real estate broker. I got a great beachfront property. It's a two-story house, right overlooking the ocean. And you come to the house and you realize this whole thing's made of sand. Yeah, so big deal. The tide's coming in. It's got a big deal. It's got a two-car garage. It's almost foolish to think like, you want me to invest in this? You want me to get a mortgage out for a giant sandcastle? This is the material world. We've put our investment into stuff. We put our investment into things of this world that we know we're going to have to lose anyway.
Right.
That's a problem. There's not a return on investment there. Our return comes from trying to find something that's more subtle. And so the subtlety is spirit. Now, how could spirit be solid? Spirit, by its very nature, I can't grip it. I can grip a car. I can grip a Ferrari. I can grip a home. I can grip my lover. I can grip my family. How am I supposed to grip spirit? That's what we're pushed to do. We have to figure out how to grip spirit, how to hold on to spirit. So in the pandemic, I was forced to. I mean, my whole business got wiped out in one sense. I couldn't travel anymore. I make my money traveling and teaching. I'm a teacher. And so I was forced to like really sort of take shelter in the teachings of the Veda and be a little bit more dependent on God and less dependent on my own cleverness in this world. And it was a blessing because it forces me to realize I actually am dependent. Mm-hmm. See, we're all actually dependent. We just forget. We think we're independent. We think we're creating our good fortune and that we have all our shit together and, you know, I've got it covered and I got this, but we don't got this. That's the illusion of the material world. The material world is you don't got this, you jackass. Rome thought they had this and then Rome fell. How could Rome fall? Rome was there for what, 600 years, 700 years? Rome fell. You don't think you can fall? Rome fell. America's only been here for a few hundred years.
Yeah.
Rome doesn't even got this.
Right.
The Ottoman Empire didn't get this. The Mughals didn't have this. The British didn't have this. They all lost it. That's the type of arrogance that we have. And sometimes it's very beautiful if you have the appropriate lens to see. If you have the appropriate lens to see that loss, pain, distress, broken hearts, these are all blessings for a person on a spiritual path because we have nowhere to take shelter of anymore except God, except Bhagavan, except our higher power, except our source. And if we're on a spiritual path, we are endeavoring to be sorcerers. What is a sorcerer? One who takes shelter in source. That's a sorcerer. And if you want to take pleasure in matter and you think you're safe with matter, well, good luck with that. Because your very body is like a sandcastle. I don't care how many superfoods you eat. I don't care how much chavanprash you eat. I don't care how much panchakarma cleanse you've done. Your very body will be taken away from you. Because the body's not eternal. the spirit's eternal. So you can, and it's important to take care of your body. I'm not making fun of that, but don't think that's your final shelter also. Your body is also disposable. It will be burned or it will be buried. And that thing that I spent years combing my hair and brushing my teeth and fixing my face and shaving, it's going to be burned. And as Shakespeare said, food for the worms.
You know, you spoke about your devotion and your commitment to the tradition that you follow, you know, your guru and the spiritual lineage that you're attracted to and, you know, pretty strongly committed to. You know, I remember you talking in the Joe Rogan podcast where you were kind of explaining your belief in your philosophy very passionately. And it's kind of difficult to explain that to an outsider, what that means to you and why you believe or why you are so committed to this tradition of devotion. What really convinced you about these spiritual thoughts, about these deep philosophical thoughts and belief systems? What nurtured and strengthened your faith in that?
I think that's a great question. People tend to think faith is like an on-off switch. Either I don't believe or I believe. I don't believe or I don't believe. You know, I don't think it's like that. And I don't ask any of my students to be like that. And I don't think the Vedic tradition asks us that. We naturally have faith in people that we look up to. Why do we look up to people? Well, they have some quality that they have. For example, great mathematician, and I want to learn math. I'll ask him some questions. Hey, I don't know anything about math. And what he does is he teaches me a little and it makes sense. And I was like, wow, he is a good source of information here. I'm going to ask him again because I've got a bigger problem I'm going to put in front of him right now. And then he again gives me a perfect answer. And I was like, whoa. And then I see he at the same time, he's won some math award in academia where it's very impressive and the society respects him. And so I ask him further. And so what happens, and that happens in every field, that happens in music and photography and the arts and athleticism. The same is true in spirit. We see some person who lives a life with integrity, has deep spiritual insight, doesn't appear to have any type of like animosity or anger towards anyone. And we hear their story, perhaps where they came from. And maybe their story wasn't so savory in the past. And we see what they've become. And we think, wow, that's impressive. Where'd you get that from? Says, well, I got it from this canon of literature. And I says, okay, that's not called blind faith. That's reasonable faith. The fact that I asked Raghav the math question was reasonable. He was a math professor, say, or respected mathematician. So I have reasonable faith that he's not going to lie to me. He could still lie to me, but I have reasonable faith that he's not going to. I think on Joe Rogan, I explained the same thing. Like you ask somebody for directions. In one sense, that's blind faith. You know, you're driving down the street, you pull over, hey, I'm lost. How do you get to, Grand Central Station? And they give you a series of instructions. And after you follow the first instruction, you go up here and you're going to see a McDonald's on the left. And you're like, oh my God, there's a McDonald's. Maybe that guy knows what he's talking about.
Right.
At first, there was a little leap of faith. I didn't fully understand like that guy was going to... There was a little leap of faith. It was reasonable faith because most people don't lie. There was maybe if he was intoxicated or drunken or a crazy teenager, you know, screwing around with other teenagers. But if I pulled over and I asked a cop or I asked someone who looked respectable, then they gave me some reason. And then once his information proved to be true, the other information, the next step also seemed to be true. More and more faith develops, and faith develops in small increments. If you're immediately saying, I believe all of this stuff, I think that's sort of foolish.
Mm-hmm.
I think faith comes in small increments, and then all of a sudden we get some deeper realizations. And that's the way I think to approach anything. And unless you have some deep realizations, if you just opt in and join some church or some club or some ashram or some mosque or some, I start to think you're crazy, man. I don't think you've spiritually enlightened. I think you're a fanatic. So I always worry about people who get into things too quickly. Mm-hmm. I find that like sometimes it's a little sketchy. Now, right. Sometimes there are people who are just very deep from childhood and they just connect immediately.
Right.
But I believe that everybody is going to get their tests. And unless they have a deep understanding philosophically of why they're doing what they're doing, they will blow over whenever there's a strong wind. Unless the tree has deep roots, they will blow. It'll blow over in the first windy day there is. So yeah. We have to not just get born into a tradition. Like you guys were born with spiritual parents, but you're both going to be forced to really deeply realize this stuff, because that's how the game of spirit and matter work. You want to get serious, you're going to get tested. There's so many pictures of these Buddhist tankas of Lord Buddha sitting there and all these demons tempting the Buddha in meditation. I don't know if you've ever seen that drawing. And in the Vedic tradition, it's the same way. They say the demigods test the jiva. Because in order to make any advancement, even in academia, you get tested and you see if you can pass the test. And if not, that's okay. It's okay if you don't pass a test. In school, you just go back to the other grade. You go back to a lower grade. You stay back a year until you learn that lesson. We get tested like that in any type of commitment, in a marriage commitment. We get tested like that in life, in the workplace. I find myself, if I don't learn a lesson, that lesson resurfaces in another situation. It's not like, okay, I got rid of that idiot and I blame that idiot for all my problems. I find that there is a lesson right in front of my face that the universe, God, Krishna, whatever you want to call Bhagavan, is trying to teach me, but I don't want to see that lesson. So I'll blame it on the situation and not see that everything is happening for me. I look at the whole world. Why me? This is unfair. This type of reactive behavior keeps us a child. When we blame the world for our sadness, it keeps us like little children. It's not fair, right? That's the mantra of the materialist.
So we've come to the final and, in a sense, the main question that we're trying to really ask and get from you is the title of this podcast, which is The Philosophy of Now. What is Raghunath's philosophy of now? And what we mean by that is, what is that sort of life mantra? What is that nugget of wisdom that you meditate upon, that you think about, that you, you know, try to keep in the back of your mind constantly in the present moment, in your now? Not something necessarily that you think about in your past, not something that you, you know, think as a vision for your future, but in your present, that keeps you grounded, that keeps you mindful constantly. What is that life mantra for you in the now that could potentially inspire even our listeners?
You know what? One nice one is, I've got a bunch because it's a good question, but we need mantras in our mind. If not, our mind gets clogged up with so many other crazy thoughts or sometimes self-deprecating thoughts. So we need some healthy mantras or sayings or sacred sounds. One nice one I like is, what does love ask from me today? What does love ask from me today?
Wow.
What does that mean to you, though? Like, how does that translate into your life?
You know, it depends on the situation. Sometimes love asks me to speak out loud and shout, and sometimes it asks for me to be quiet and be soft. Sometimes it means to be like internal. Sometimes it means to just go for a walk and chant quietly in my beads. Sometimes it means sit still. Sometimes it means I just got to get out and, you know, have fun with my family. So it's different. So it's a nice prayer to go inside and evaluate the situation and see if I can be that being of love instead of the being of greed, the being of ego, the being of my unlimited desires, and be a being of service and of love. What do you think of that?
That's so insightful. It's very well said.
It's hard to apply, but I'm a work in progress.
As we all are. What a way to conclude. That was a beautiful conversation, Rugby. Thank you for your time and insight. It was a very constructive conversation.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Philosophy of Now podcast. For more content and conversations like this, please visit the Roots Media website and keep listening.